My friend, we are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Okay, it's Radio Mysterioso back here after a couple week hiatus. I was out of the country, and then we were out at the China Lake Naval Weapons Center, actually looking at petroglyphs, if you can believe that. And my guest this week, after this long hiatus, we are very lucky to have Dr. Dean Radin on. Actually, I interviewed Dr. Radin in 1997, I believe, when his first book, Conscious Universe, came out. At that point, he was affiliated with the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. And we actually had an interview scheduled. Went over and met him at his house. This was during NAB, so there were millions of people in town. And we were supposed to have a couple-hour interview, I guess, over at a cafe near your place, and it ended up being like 5 hours. They were actually setting up for dinner by the time we were finished. And I tell that story to people to let them know that at that point, Dr. Radin had no idea who I was or exactly what I was doing, but he took the pains to explain very carefully everything that I did not understand. And that took 5 hours. That was eventually all my stupid comments were eventually edited out of the interview, which appeared in the magazine and then later in the book in its full form in the excluded middle book. The first book, like I said, was called The Conscious Universe. That was published in 1997. The second book, which is his most recent, I believe, was Entangled Minds, published in 2007. I think that was Simon & Schuster. And it took what was described in the first book, I believe, reiterated it, parapsychological research, how far it had come, and things that you didn't know, especially if you were highly skeptical of the research, and very carefully explained that it is not something that is a theory or that is worthy of, you know, is something that is worthy of serious scientific scrutiny and had been for a long time. What Entangled Minds does is take that evidence, assume that it is, you know, robust enough that we can work with it, and then try and explore a little bit how, you know, the functioning part of psi, which it's called, parapsychology, it studies psi, right, Dr. Radin?
That's right.
That's the Greek letter. Incidentally, the 23rd letter of the Greek alphabet. Right now, Dr. Radin is the senior scientist at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which was founded in 1973 by astronaut Edgar Mitchell. What they do there is support research in human consciousness. So what I said to Dr. Radin before the show is people listening to this show probably don't really need too much convincing that what he has been researching for many years has enough of a background in experimental proof to show that it does exist, although we will discuss that a little bit. So we'll also concentrate on some of the findings, possibilities, theories, and what they, you know, what the implications of those might be. The first thing I wanted to ask you is, it's in your bio about what kind of person would be interested in parapsychological research and why you were particularly, but maybe we can hear that in your own words.
Are you asking why I got interested in this field?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, there's a number of reasons. One of the easiest to explain is if you ask most children today what has been formative for them in terms of what they've read, and maybe movies as well. But many children will say that the Harry Potter series of books was one of the first times that they got very deeply involved in a long story. And the same is true for me. I read the equivalent of Harry Potter in my childhood. At that time, it was fairy tales and mythology and science fiction. And, of course, it stimulates the imagination, which one hopes that all children can experience. And so the only difference then between the average public and scientists is that most scientists are driven by imagination and curiosity. Mm-hmm. And so it's exactly the same for me. I became very curious about the possibility that some of these stories, which seem to resonate so strongly in science fiction and in fairy tales, that sure, it's, you know, it's story, it's embellishment and fantasy, but maybe there really is something deeper underneath the stories that that is worth pursuing. So that was probably the origins of how I got interested in these topics, and then turning that into a discipline, into a career, is much more difficult. But at least the origin of the interest is there. And it's very clear, just from looking at the lineup on television over the past 20 or 30 years, that the interest is there for everyone. Otherwise, those TV shows and movies wouldn't be on the air all the time.
Yeah. Well, I kind of think what they're doing is telling people that there's more than they're officially told, and people at some intuitive level, and sometimes more than that, know that.
Right. And a lot of the skepticism, at least from a mainstream scientific perspective, comes from a theoretical stance. In fact, almost all of it is based on theory. That it's true that today science has not yet evolved to the point where it's crystal clear why people would have telepathic connections or why precognition ought to exist. And scientists are conservative by nature, and we tend to rely a lot on our theories as explanations. And if the theory is not there, then many scientists are so strongly influenced by theory that they'll assume that the phenomena simply don't exist. I believe, though, that that's probably the minority. I'm guessing 20% of scientists are in that camp, and maybe 80% are much more open to either the possibility or the certainty that some psychic phenomena are real, even though we don't know yet how to explain it.
It's kind of amazing for me to hear you say that, because I would figure it was a lot lower, and maybe a lot lower than when we talked over 10 years ago. It seemed like some walls have come down. Maybe that's just because older people are dying out.
I think some of it is because of the extremely fast advancements in modern physics, in particular in quantum mechanics. Hmm. As younger people come along and they're more used to the ideas that are presented in quantum theory, our idea about the nature of physical reality itself is beginning to change. And so you're correct that older people, especially older scientists who grew up with a classical physical view of the universe, for them this was such a radical leap to imagine that the holism, which is one of the central components of psi phenomena, it suggests something like a holistic environment that we live in. That idea was so radical that it was simply too radical. They couldn't accept that something like that was real. And probably the most famous person as an exemplar of this was Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
So if Einstein couldn't accept it, then it's not unreasonable that a couple of previous generations, maybe going back four or five generations of scientists, they couldn't believe it either.
Yeah.
So we're headed into a new millennium now.
I remember in Entangled Minds, which I recently read, that Einstein actually wrote a paper answering the quantum theory with a couple of other scientists sometime in the 1920s or 30s, was it?
1930s.
Right. What was the basis of his problem with quantum theory?
Well, they had a number of problems, but the paper you're referring to is the famous EPR paper, the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, and in which the famous phrase "spooky action at a distance" is traced back to. What Einstein was referring to is the idea in quantum mechanics that physical systems can be in superpositions. In other words, that they can be spread out like waves and interact in the way that waves will. And remember at the time that physicality was imagined to be primarily particulate, like little atoms were separate little objects. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of a superposition was considered a mathematical nicety and useful in an abstract way, but certainly not reflective of the way that the world actually is. Mm-hmm. And so that paper was written as a way of saying, look how absurd this idea of matter as waves is, because certainly the universe doesn't work that way. And it took another 30 years before the physicist John Bell figured out a way of testing if, in fact, the world does work the way that quantum mechanics suggested, that there are superpositions of that the world lives in superpositions, wave-like potentials. Mm-hmm. It was tested and found to be real. And so today, students who are learning about quantum mechanics will learn about non-locality and superposition and quantum coherence and all these things that 70 to 80 years ago were still considered at the leading edge of physics, and no one actually knew whether it was real or not. Now we know it's real.
Yeah, and the way it's you described it in your book, and it's probably been described other places as the wave part of this, the superposition, is illustrated by the fact that you can have three or four different sources of waves, like in a tank, and they all intersect with each other, but they don't really bother each other. They just keep going, not like something physical where something would hit and then bounce off and be affected that way.
Yes, although waves also show interference phenomena, which is important. So if the crests of the waves happen to meet up at the same time in the same place, then you'll get a stronger wave. And mm-hmm. if not, then you can end up reducing the size of the wave. And the waves we're talking about here are waves of potential, or like probabilistic waves. And it's still not completely sure whether the waves are ontologically real, but that's the way the world works. At least that's our best mathematical models now depend on waves of potential as a way of describing what's happening at a level of reality below what our common sense tells us.
Yeah, the common sense doesn't seem as common when you start looking into it. And then when, you know, somebody like me reading it, I almost found comfort in the quote you had from Richard Feynman saying it doesn't make sense. It's insane. I think it's insane. It doesn't make sense. Yet there it is.
Yeah. But this should not be surprising, because common sense is literally what our senses, our ordinary senses, tell us. And if it weren't for the invention of the microscope, then virtually all of modern biology would not be common sense, because you can't see that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about the level of a cell and below. If it weren't for telescopes, then modern cosmology wouldn't make any sense either. So we've extended our senses through the use of instruments, and now common sense is much, much bigger than it was a century ago, and bigger than a century before that, so on. And as new instruments are developed, our sense of what makes common sense will continue to expand.
Yeah, science will continue to evolve. One thing you said in our interview last time, which has stuck with me, is that looking at these phenomena and trying to understand the psychic effects and ideas is like trying to describe them, actually, is like trying to kill a fly with a sledgehammer.
Well, it's true. We're somewhere between Benjamin Franklin flying a kite and looking at sparks on a key, and from there to the modern electrical power grid. So the experiences of psychic phenomena that people have are kind of like the electrical power grid. These are real things, in your face, actual experiences. But the place where science is at right now is Franklin looking at the sparks during a lightning storm and trying to figure, well, what is that? Mm-hmm. It's the analogy is pretty close because Franklin could create the sparks. He figured out an experimental way to do it. It was pretty erratic. He couldn't always get it to happen because he needed to have a lightning storm. When it did happen, he wasn't completely sure what it is that he was looking at. It was pretty weak. And for him to, at that point, to have imagined two or three centuries down the line where people would have basically the entire modern world runs on those sparks, and that we'd have both theoretical and practical ways of working with them, it might even have exceeded his imagination. So, you know, I'm involved in a line of research which is kind of like looking at sparks, and they're sort of weak, and it's hard to make them appear in the lab every single time, but it's quite real, I'm convinced of that. And so when I think a couple centuries down the line, it's very difficult for me to know how or if better understanding of these sparks will change the future. I suspect that it will, and I suspect it will in ways that we don't actually have a good understanding for yet.
Apart from you and a few others you describe in your book, how many people do you think or know of that are involved in the same kind of research as you?
I think the number worldwide is probably around 20 to 30 people who were trained as scientists and actively engaged in this sort of research. On the one hand, that's completely shocking.
Yeah,
it's shocking because if 99% of the general public, including scientists, are interested in this topic, you would expect more than 20 or 30 people to actually be looking into it in a serious way. Now, that's not true when we go to what might be considered amateurs, not in a disparaging way, but simply in a way of meaning that this is not people's profession. And I'm talking about people who do haunting investigations or ghost busting. Mm-hmm. I imagine there are thousands of people, hundreds of groups, thousands of people doing this, and it's a reasonable expression of popular interest. I mean, it's of course fueled by TV and movies all the time, and some of it probably from experiences as well. But when you get down to the laboratory experiments on this, it requires a little bit more training, a lot more patience, and some money. And there's very little of all of that to go around. So while there may be 20 or 30 people doing these kinds of experiments, I would say there probably are 100 or so, or maybe even 200 scientists and scholars who are well aware of the data and the literature. But because of the lack of money, you don't have 200 people doing these kinds of experiments. It's much, much more limited than that.
Do you think it would make any difference if 200 people were doing the experiments, really?
Of course.
Just because of the concatenation of everything and also the idea that so many people were looking at the same thing, I guess. It would be kind of a hit some kind of a Rubicon of a turnover of social acceptance or whatever you want to call it.
Some of it would be that. It might help push a tipping point to get rid of the taboo that prevents there from being more interest. But there's also just a very pragmatic reason that it's extremely difficult to make significant progress when you have a very small trickle of studies being done. You need a critical mass of intellect and bodies doing things in order to make faster progress. And so would it matter if there are 20 people versus 200? Well, of course, you have 10 times more people doing things. You have 10 times the speed of advancement. And mm-hmm. if you had 2,000 people, you have 100 times faster. So the number of people engaged in this makes a huge difference in terms of how fast we learn.
Do you think that's going to take very long before more people are doing such a thing, or does it seem kind of bleak at this point?
It's a strange question because the number of scientists in many domains who are interested and would do research in this field if they thought they can get away with it is probably as high as it has ever been. I would guess easily there are thousands.
Wow.
And most of them are in the academic world. In the academic world, you cannot do this kind of research. At least you can't do it for very long. If you have tenure, you can get away with it. If you don't have tenure, you won't get tenure. And so there's a built-in prejudice within the academic world, which you would think is the place where academic freedom thrives and where new ideas can come to light and all that. And some of that is true, but not in certain areas. And because of the academia runs a lot slower than the rest of the world, you know, things don't change very quickly because if you're trying to teach undergraduates things that are very likely to be true, you have to run behind where the leading edge is. And so textbooks now are brought up to date more quickly than they used to be, but it's still probably 10 to 20 years behind in many subjects, especially at the lower class levels in undergraduate school.
Mm-hmm.
At the graduate level, most of it is probably more up to date. But by the time people reach graduate school, they're already on a career track, and there is no career track for this realm. So even if there is personal interest, there's no way to express that interest. That's why the couple of universities that give accredited degrees where you could specialize in a parapsychological topic are mostly schools for non-residents and for adults. You know, like after college, not for college kids. So it is possible to do advanced study in these areas, but it's at that point it's no longer about a career, it's about an interest.
Well, considering the amount of credentialed scientists that are involved in this research, it would seem like they're kind of a hardy group that don't really care what people think and maybe have some either tenure or or they're just involved in private research and industry or something like that.
Are you talking about the 20 or 30 people?
Yes, people like you and Edwin May and Roger Spottiswood, people like that.
Probably not Roger Spottiswood because a movie director wouldn't do it, but his brother James.
James, I'm sorry.
That's what you meant.
Excuse me.
Although it would be interesting to have a movie director involved in this kind of research. And Roger is James' brother. So
that I did not know. Okay.
Yeah. Part of it is doing a little projection from myself here on what motivates other people. Some of it is simply being iconoclastic by personality. And if you care a lot about what other people think, then you will not drift from the herd. And there are very pragmatic reasons for doing that. You know, we're social animals, and if you are too different from other people, then you can't be amongst them. The academic world has the same pressure, social pressures, as any other domain, and so it's a process that weeds out certain kinds of individuals. Another type is people who always wanted to do this but were willing to play along with the necessities of playing the science game, but then got tenure or near retirement or at retirement, and at that point you don't care anymore. You don't have to care anymore, and then you can do what you want. And then another class are I guess people like me who rather than going into the academic world first, I went into industrial research. And within industrial research is much less concerned about the social constraints of the academic world. And it's much more interested in pragmatics. So if the pragmatics of your job is such that it leaves some time to do something else as well, then you do something else. In my case, I did cyber research because that's what I was interested in. And so in all of these cases, there's some streak of independence and maybe rebellion because you are pushing hard against your peers. So that has to be something that you enjoy or at least are willing to put up with.
Yeah. What places have you worked and what that allowed you to do this kind of research?
Well, my first job after getting my doctorate was at Bell Laboratories. And so Bell Labs, at the time, there was still a Bell system, a single telephone system in the United States.
Yep.
The monopoly had advantages. It allowed the development of Bell Labs, which was the largest laboratory in the world at the time, I think. About 50,000 scientists and technicians. The place where everything from the transistor to the cell phone were developed. And it's because of both the size of the lab and the support that the monopoly of AT&T was able to provide that allowed for all of these inventions. And then the monopoly was broken up, and basically Bell Labs, it didn't disappear, but it dramatically changed. And much of the basic research that was done at AT&T it disappeared. But Bell Labs, when I was working there, was still a unified whole. And so I worked on projects that oftentimes would involve anywhere between 5 and 25 other people. And sometimes you'd be working on something and you had to wait for some other people or a subgroup to finish what they're doing before you can continue. Well, that left roughly 20% of my time with nothing to do. So I decided, well, I don't want to do nothing. So I started doing experiments on precognition and mind-matter interaction. And I wanted to be clear with my management that that this wasn't necessarily part of my official duties, but it was also something that I could do at work and that I could publish when I had finished something. And so it went up a couple levels of management, and nobody had any serious problem with it, so that's what I did. It was through that experience that I started to meet other researchers in the field around the world and go to conferences, and that's what gave me the idea that maybe it's possible to actually have a career in a field in which there isn't one. And the way you do it is the way you do any kind of career development. You network with the right people. You demonstrate that you're competent. And that's what I did for many years.
When I first talked to you, well, the only other time I talked to you, really, you were at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, and I can't remember what your position was there. And if you had left there because of some problems with the university at all because of the research you were involved in.
I was the director of something called the Consciousness Research Laboratory, which was a department within the Harry Reid Center for Environmental Studies, which is a research center on the campus of UNLV. Mm-hmm. I went there because I was offered a position, which I kind of created, from the Bigelow Foundation.
Oh,
Robert,
okay.
Bigelow is now known more for his space hotels,
right,
enterprise than other things. But at the time, he was interested in psychic phenomena as well. So I had an offer which I couldn't refuse, basically. And so I took it up. So I was there for about 4 years. And shortly after my book was published and I started to get more attention, problems began, primarily driven by the provost at the time. I'm not going to go into all of the details because I'd have to say things that could end up being libelous, or
all right.
And I don't want to deal with that. But let's just say that there are certain people within the administration there who felt that this was not a good topic for the university to deal with. And so they suggested that I leave. So I did, and I left to go to a job that paid almost three times the salary, and also in an environment where I had about $500,000 budget a year. So I went from a highly contentious, very low-paying position to one which was much better on many different dimensions. So I wasn't sorry to leave at all. The place I went to was called Interval Research Corporation, which was in Palo Alto, which is like the heart of Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Interval research was an experiment created by Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft. Paul wanted a 10-year experiment where he'd bring together the cream of the crop from Xerox PARC, from the MIT Media Lab, from Apple, from Stanford, so on, to create the, as he called it, the wired world. At the future of consumer electronics with a world where the internet was central rather than an up-and-coming phenomenon. So this was, I was there from 1998 and 1999, and had started in 1992. So it was through the near the end of the interval experiment. I don't remember exactly how many patents that came up with, excepting a few thousand, 3,000 perhaps, patents, many of which are now embedded or central in things that we take for granted. Just one thing I can think of off the top of my head is for the Xbox, there's the, I forget the name, it's like Kinetic, something like that. The mm-hmm. thing that watches your movements and then puts you in a game based on watching your movements, as opposed to a Wii controller where you have to actually hold something and move it around.
Yeah.
So that's using machine vision to find where the body is and then translate the movement of the body into a game. So that was one of the things that that was being developed at Interval. And it's consumer electronics, obviously. In that case, it didn't have anything to do with the wired world. But it was one of many, many projects that was taking, that was projecting advancements in technology that could prove to be useful in some way for games, for lots of other applications, and then more low-level stuff that can turn into things like Bluetooth and other advanced technologies. So what was I doing there? Well, I was there because about 10% of the projects at Interval were designed to push the envelope even farther and to remind people who are doing more technologically and short-term work that there are many things that we still don't understand very well. So my project, we dubbed it, each project had a code name. Mine was called Phenome Project, and it was based on the idea of, just as in biology, you have a genome, which is the essence of the biology. And in this case, the phenome was the essence of the psyche. That's how we thought of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Phenome Project, it was largely created by a colleague named Dick Schaup, who had been at Interval from the beginning. And he was always very interested in cyber-search, and I knew him independently of Interval. He was a senior manager there, and he arranged to create this project and basically recruited me to do it. So it was a very easy transition for me leaving UNLV to step right into this new position at Interval. And we did a number of experiments. We had at one point, we were asked by Paul Allen to do an independent review of the experiments that we had done. So we invited 10 independent scientists, including a couple of very well-known skeptics, to come in and look at the experiments that we were doing and to write a formal report, and all of that was sent up to Paul Allen. And that probably consumed half a year of our work. And the reports basically said that this research is as good as it's going to get. It looks like there's some real phenomena, and it's worth continuing. So even among the most skeptical reviewers. The thing about that, I wish I could publish all of those reviews, because for the more sympathetic people, it's not too surprising they would say that.
Yeah.
But for the skeptics to say that, some of whom are well-known names, would be surprising. And yet we designed from the get-go, all of the reviews would remain basically company private and confidential to allow them to say what they wanted to say without fear of what their peers might think. because we're all sensitive to the idea that if you're working in a taboo area, you have to know what you say and to whom you're saying it. So I have those reports, and maybe someday when those people die, and if I'm still alive, then I'll publish it.
Yeah, that would probably be an eye opener, and it would help the entire cause of getting more research money, people interested in the implications of Psi research and pushing it further. Maybe we can talk a little bit about what was kind of the nitty gritty of the research, the theories, and all that. And I'll go. I usually jump around in my questions. My first question in here, which I first encountered in your book, and I guess it's an old idea, was the idea of latent inhibition. Mm-hmm. And I thought it'd be valuable to explain that, why it's important in Psi research, and why you brought it up so early in the book.
Well, now you're asking me to go back actually to 2005 when I wrote that book. It was published in 2006.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was 2007. Never mind.
Yeah. So I would have to I don't know the details of it anymore. I find that it's interesting when I do interviews on books, that especially books that have been published quite a while ago. For the person who is reading it, this is fresh and new information. But I wrote it a long time ago, and I don't remember the details.
Oh, that same thing's happened to me. People say, you know, you wrote about this. I said, I did. I have no idea that I even ever discussed that. But okay.
Yeah. So you're aware then that asking a question like latent inhibition, which I kind of remember writing about, but I actually don't remember the details. So I don't want to sound authoritative on it because I'm sure I'll make a mistake.
Well, that's okay. We can skip it.
I can say, however, that this is not a question you've asked yet, but I'll offer it anyway.
Yeah.
That I have a book coming out next July, so in 2013, you'll see a book called Supernormal. That's the title, Supernormal. And the subtitle is Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities. What that book is about is looking at the lore within yoga, but also within other esoteric and religious contexts, the lore for the supernormal, and I make a distinction here between supernormal and supernatural. Mm-hmm. Supernatural meaning things that are divine and not of the natural world, whereas supernormal are just like normal things, but slightly better. So all esoteric traditions have ideas about supernormal abilities that will arise as a result of either grit or grace. So I'm not interested in the grace part because that's essentially talent, and talent happens. But for grit, meaning practice, the idea that you can practice in certain ways and gain supernormal abilities, including psychic abilities, that also exists in most traditions. So I use yoga as a way of getting into the topic because yoga is so popular now, and because most Westerners who practice yoga or do meditation may not realize the esoteric roots of that practice. Mm-hmm. So that's what the new book is about. And in the process, I bring the laboratory research up to date and talk about some of the more more extreme versions of psychic effects that are in the legends, but have so far yet to be studied very carefully in the laboratory. Mm-hmm. So that's my little advertisement for what's coming up. And now you can go back to your questions.
No, we don't have to. I write down questions as a kind of a general guide. If we get involved in talking about something else, I will forget the questions at least for a while, at least the ones I have written down. Because just when you were describing what the new book is about, I remembered the you had said we were talking about psychic ability at one point, and you were saying, well, it's, you know, everybody has it, just like everybody can play basketball. It's just some people can do it really, really well. Mm-hmm. And some people do it through a combination of talent and grit, as you say, and some people are just gifted with it. Right. And some of the problems you encounter is that you have to get people that are very good at this, supposedly, to do some of this work, do some of these experiments.
Right. And so the curious thing, the reason why I was interested in yoga is because I've practiced yoga over the years. My wife has practiced it a lot, and I meditate. And in that tradition, within that tradition, it's very well accepted that the siddhis, so-called, S-I-D-D-H-I, the siddhis are the super normal abilities that arise as a result of long-term meditation practice. So it's when I give a talk at a traditional yoga ashram, for example, and I ask how many people believe in or through your experience may have experienced something like telepathy. Well, any kind of psychic thing I mention, 100% of everyone says yes. And this is not only in the case where people are at an ashram because they work there, but people who are visiting and just people who are involved in that realm of mind-body advancement, they all have these experiences. So it suggests that some of the lore is probably correct. And so that was the origin of thinking about why yoga in particular might be an interesting way of getting into this topic. But the lore also says, and this is true almost across the board, it says basically that these phenomena will arise with diligent practice, but you should not demonstrate it to anyone. Not only anyone out there in the public, but in particular in the Yoga Sutras, it says that even if an honored teacher asks you to demonstrate your abilities, you still should refuse. And the reason why this comes about is because part of the development of the yoga path, or any esoteric path of development, it recognizes early on that when you get your ego involved in these phenomena, that it's dangerous for you. It extinguishes the phenomena ultimately, and it draws you off of the path from through which the supernormal phenomena are just a side effect. They're like they're not meaningless, but they're minor side effects that, if you're not careful, will draw you off the path. So this means that if you're looking for the super psychics to test in the laboratory, people who have trained as yogis, for example, it's very, very difficult to find people who are at the top of their game, because they by the very notion of the training, you shall not demonstrate it.
Yeah, that's another thing that has come up in conversation with people, including you, was that somebody with some sort of, I guess you could call it psychic ability, presentiment ability, any of these phenomenon, the minute they start either showing off or taking money for it or whatever you want to call it, as you say, the ego gets involved, the ability, tends to disappear, but it seems like it's either corrupted or just disappears.
It's not clear that it disappears completely, because the traditions also say that it is possible, for example, to earn a living as an oracle or as a psychic reader.
Or it gets muddled, I should say.
It becomes distorted, and more importantly, as with any power, it corrupts. And so the ego becomes inflated. If it becomes your business and your livelihood, then, for example, there are famous stories of people who apparently have had powers, who became famous for those powers, and then were caught cheating. And so the safe thing to do is say, well, they were always cheating. I think a more realistic thing is that at one point they actually did have those abilities, but the pressure to perform is so intense when somebody earns their living that way that if they have to cheat in order to be able to show an effect, they will.
Yeah, this
and
is.
So go ahead. I think this is like probably the oldest repeating story among gurus.
Yeah, it's also the oldest repeating story amongst I say fundamentalist skeptics, because a skeptic is what you want. You want somebody that doesn't take things on face value. A fundamentalist skeptic is somebody who already has their mind made up, and so their belief system drives what they're going to see, look at, and how they're going to judge. But the main, you know, problem is people that see somebody like, I suppose, a, you know, obvious example would be Uri Geller, and saying, well, he cheats. Well, he's been caught cheating. And that the assumption is, well, they cheat all the time. But there are countless laboratory experiments with him and others where there was really, as far as we can tell, no possibility of cheating, and yet effects were observed. So, and it becomes a horrible slippery slope, unfortunately, and it's the charlatans kind of mess things up. That's another thing I wanted to ask you. How does that, you know, somebody like John Edward or Uri Geller or somebody like that affect the work that you do and how you try to get, you know, gently, you know, suggest to people that there is something real here and something that deserves scrutiny and has been, is repeatable?
Well, it makes things a little bit more complex, but you can't blame somebody who may have some actual talent from expressing it the way that they want.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's whenever you deal with a controversial topic, you're going to raise all kinds of different opinions, and there's going to be polarization, and anybody who's looking for either a positive or negative spin will look for any example that they can find.
Yeah.
And so if somebody becomes famous and is a popular figure, then it's not surprising that that person will be evoked either in a positive or negative way. So, I mean, that's just the name of the game.
Right.
And it's of course, not just true here. It's true in any domain where there's controversy. I mean, we see that in political elections now. That's practically all we ever see in the politics of it. The advertising is completely spinning positive or negative based on oftentimes the exact same events.
Yeah, of course. So, go ahead.
So does it make a difference? Well, in a positive way, yes, and that it brings it to public awareness. In a negative way, because it confuses people as to what I do versus what they do.
Do people try to use your work to kind of shore up something that you think might not have as much proof behind it, I would say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, oftentimes from the strong believer side, people will say that what we're doing proves something, whatever their pet thing is that they like. And I try to caution them by saying, well, no, actually, science is not about proof. It's about evaluation of evidence, and I have to use all of the qualifying words to kind of pull back from the idea that we're proving anything. At this point, all we're proving is that we're actually not as smart as we thought we were, and that while we were pretty sure that there's real phenomena going on here, we don't understand it very well yet. As we often find, and this is true in any area of science and scholarship too, the more you understand something or the more you study something, the more complex it becomes. Like a really good example is DNA. You know, in the early stages of understanding DNA, people kind of felt that, well, okay, the gene explains it all. Everything's explained by genes. And so you finish the Human Genome Project and are distressed to find that a banana has more genes than a human. So that forced a rethinking of, well, what are the genes? And then now that, you know, that was a decade ago. Now we have a much more sophisticated view of what's going on genetically. And it just barely scratched the surface. I mean, there are many, many surprises in our future, I'm convinced, in virtually every scientific domain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read well, it's probably published a while ago, but I have a online kind of subscription to Nature, and one of the articles was discussing a while ago how junk DNA was called junk because nobody knew what it did.
Right. But you find the same thing in cosmology with dark energy and dark matter. In that case, the cosmologists have not labeled it junk energy and junk matter, which I suppose they could have, but it's essentially the same kind of thing. That we've been looking at a even with our sophisticated instruments, we're looking at a sliver of reality. And the deeper we probe, the more interesting and complex and mysterious it becomes. So you then, you know, you go from that realm and into the human psyche as something that you can imagine has depth. And we just barely have dipped below the surface. And every time we do that, it becomes more and more interesting and mysterious. So I'm guessing that what we see as psychic phenomena are the tail end, it's like the surface end of something which is much more interesting. Like, you know, it's we're looking at the way that the universe is expressing itself through our awareness. But when a telepathic experience occurs, it's not like mental radio from one person to the next. It's something much deeper than that. And again, I'll go back to yoga for a second, because when you look at these ancient philosophies that were developed largely because of thousands of years of introspection, all the instruments that they had were their own mind. They didn't have the tools of technology. And so if you imagine that after a couple of hundred generations of people diving into their own awareness, that they maybe would have learned something. And what they seem to have learned is that the universe is inside us, literally, mm-hmm. and that some aspect of our consciousness can actually experience that directly. Maybe if that's true, I kind of suspect it is true, it's certainly compatible with psychic phenomena. At some point then, when our cosmology advances to some refined level way beyond where it is today, we'll end up back inside us. This is where I think in my first book, The Conscious Universe, I had this nice picture of a yin-yang symbol, where if you start purely examining the world from an external point of view, you will cycle around eventually and end up inside. Mm-hmm. So the outside and the inside are the same when you look at it in a deep enough way. And this is the essence of the perennial wisdom. This is what the ancient yogis were trying to tell us, but they didn't have the language that we have today. So when we read it today with the Western mind, it sounds kind of nutty.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have the language to describe it completely. They tried to, and we've got, I think, like, go back to the fly with the sledgehammer thing. That's what the language is available to us,
right?
To try and describe what you've been working on for many years. At the end of it, I think Jacques Vallée was on Coast to Coast once. At the end of one of the segments, and they never went back to it, he said, what we seem to find is that we seem to be a subset of something else. And they never went back to that with him, and I thought that was probably one of the most fascinating things he'd said in the whole interview. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading your book, it sounded to me like kind of a description of classical physics. It's a subset of what quantum theory is kind of scratching at and trying to get towards.
Right. Yeah, quantum theory is not the end of physics. Something will supplant it eventually. I strongly suspect that whatever that is will initially be regarded as radical as quantum mechanics was perceived, and the consequences of it will be as strong as well. Now, you know, most in physics, most of it is about how do you reconcile general relativity with quantum mechanics. That's probably a step in the right direction, but what's often left out of the mainstream physics thrust is the mind-like nature or the informational-like nature of quantum theory. Mm-hmm. And you can find books and some people talking about this within the physics mainstream, but it's a tricky and difficult topic that we don't know yet how to take the next step, but eventually someone will figure that out, and that's where we're going to find all kinds of radical new stuff.
Well, it seems like what we do is try to describe things in kind of very rough metaphors, which is never what the thing is, which I guess why a lot of physicists like to use mathematical formula. It's a little more elegant, but it's not really adequate to describe these ideas to most people or people who are not scientists.
It's difficult. It's difficult to translate the mathematical equations into ontology.
Yeah.
Because unlike classical physics, there's no one-to-one relationship anymore between the mathematics and the world at large. I mean, now we're dealing with strange probabilistic potential wave-like things, which you can never measure directly. You can only see their indirect effects. And so if you have something that's already so difficult to describe, to try to hang it onto language or even metaphors becomes a job more for a storyteller than it does for a physicist. And of course, physicists as well are reluctant to get drawn into what has become a kind of a popular culture simplification of quantum theory.
Yeah.
And because you can now find products with the word quantum in it, everything from toothpaste to toilet paper, I'm sure it makes physicists shudder because they're seeing a very elegant and almost entirely mathematical theory used in ways that would probably horrify Schrödinger and Heisenberg.
Well, you know, maybe whatever method it takes. I know I don't have a very good, you know, positive understanding of quantum theory. I kind of grasp at it, but I can see it in you know, in the way you describe how it informs your research.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of the projects I've been working on for the last couple of years now is directly related to this issue of quantum ontology. Like, what is this theory trying to tell us if we think of it not just in terms of the mathematics and its ability to make predictions, but what does it tell us about reality, about the world we live in? So the aspect that I'm studying is the quantum measurement problem, and this is the observation within quantum experiments that if you observe a quantum system, that its behavior changes. Now, from a traditional point of view, the word observation is a little tricky, and what they would say is, no, it has nothing to do with observation in the sense of conscious observation or consciousness, but only has to do with the means of measurement. And when you take a measurement of a quantum system, that the measurement itself changes the description of the system, because quantum systems are described basically as the way that you interact with it. So I would say, well, consciousness has nothing to do with it. But that's not exactly true, because ultimately you never know whether a measurement has been taken or not. You have to look at it. And so this line of thinking brought about Schrödinger's cat and Wigner's friend and a whole line of ideas about the role of consciousness or the potential role of consciousness in quantum measurement. And this is not a resolved issue. The quantum measurement problem is still a problem in physics. There have been many, many proposed solutions, and as with any unsolved mystery, there are lots of people who have very confident about their proposed explanation. But realistically, it is actually not very well understood why measurement of quantum systems changes the behavior of the system. One of the naive explanations for why, if you measure the behavior of a photon, for example, it changes. Or if it's maybe an electron is a better example. You have an electron like a little BB, and you shoot the BB, and you measure its position or its momentum or something else about some other property of the BB, then it changes. Well, people could say, well, it changed because you had to capture it in some way. You know, you brushed against it when you did the measurement, or you did something like that, and that changed what it was doing. Hmm. But there have been many experiments done now with detection systems that don't change the particle at all, or change it to such a small degree that it's infinitesimally small, but you still gain information about what's going on. And it's been shown again and again now that it's simply the act of getting information about the particle that changes its behavior. And the most dramatic way of seeing that is in the double slit experiment, mm-hmm. where you shoot photons through a double slit. And the change in behavior is that it acts like a particle or it acts like a wave, depending on what you know about the behavior of the photon. So I've been looking at this and experimentally in a laboratory where you ask people purely with their mind to imagine that they can gain information from a sealed optical system, which is a double slit system. And the reason why we use that as a target of your attention is because if, in fact, your mind can get information about the behavior of light inside a double-slit system, then the interference pattern that it produces would change, and it would change in a predictable direction. Namely, it would show less interference because the interference is a wave phenomena, and the wave only exists when you're not looking. The moment you look, the wave goes away. So this allows us to create an experiment which is essentially a physics experiment, but we're using clairvoyance to try to gain information from it. So what we have is the world's most complicated and sophisticated clairvoyance detector, where if clairvoyance is real, then we would predict certain changes. So I've done a number of experiments using systems like this, either specifically a double slit system or, in one case, a Michelson interferometer. And they both have the same, both based on the same idea, that if you gain information from that system, that it will change its behavior. And we found evidence in all of those experiments. Let's see, I've published one in one paper and six in another paper, and I have two more that I'm working on now to publish. So we'll have nine experiments using the same paradigm. And altogether, it's very, very clear that the evidence is showing that the behavior of the interference pattern is different when you ask people to direct their mind towards the system than when you ask them to withdraw their mind. That tells us that at least one interpretation of quantum mechanics, namely that the consciousness is part of the measurement problem, there is now empirical support for that idea.
Okay, in theory, I understand what you're talking about, but I'm going to be stupid here. If you're getting information from the double slit and the interferometer, aren't you affecting the system by doing that? Or how do you get by the two, you know, you observing it and the person affecting it by thinking about it?
Well, the beauty of this is that observation, like extracting information out of the system through observation, and then remember now this is mental observation, only mental, it's a sealed system. So extracting information and influencing it, like pushing the beam around, pushing the photons around, it's the same thing. It's the same phenomena. If you were able to magically say, okay, I want you to be purely clairvoyant and only gain information, do nothing other than simply observe with a disembodied eye, that would cause the interference pattern to change because you've extracted information from the system. If, on the other hand, you have somebody who is a psychokinetic genius and can push light beams around and gain no information but simply push the light beam around, that would produce an effect which looks the same way. So it's not just a clairvoyance detector. It's like a psi detector in general. The instruction that we give for participants in the experiment is to mentally try to get information out of it. But some people find that difficult to do. So we give an alternate explanation or instruction, which is to try to push where the photons are going. So people have tried it in both modes. I don't think it matters much in terms of what is actually going on, but the results are indistinguishable. So we've created what amounts to a way of demonstrating that there's some aspect of what we might think of as a non-local consciousness which can get inside a sealed optical system and cause it to behave in a different way. And not only a different way, but a way that we can predict how it ought to behave.
So the person is basically imagining what's going on and trying to influence it, and then you record what has happened?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So you run the experiment continuously for, say, half an hour. Mm-hmm. The system's on all the time. And for 30-second intervals, you tell somebody, now for this next 30 seconds, put your mind in the box. Put it where we showed you where the double slit was. Put your mind there. Imagine you can see the photons going through the double slit. And then instructions, okay, now withdraw your mind and relax. Think about something else. And so you do this back and forth in a counterbalanced way. All the instructions are given by a computer, so there's no human intervention in it.
See this as random.
What's random?
The intervals at which people are asked to do this is random, and you don't know what they're going to be. All that happens is their influence, and then you look later to see if those random events correlate with a change in the recording of whatever they're trying to influence, the two slits or whatever it is.
Right. It's not completely random. The influence periods are uniformly 30 seconds.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We chose 30 seconds because that's about the limit of what an untrained mind can do. Mm-hmm. Meditators can do that a lot easier, but the average person off the street for about 30 seconds can pay close attention to something. And in this case, they're not looking at something, they're just imagining it in their head.
Right.
The rest period is random. The length of that is random, typically from around 30 to 40 seconds.
I see.
Each time. So the timing of it is randomized. And then since we know exactly when those periods were, we can go back into the stream of data and measure whether the interference pattern has collapsed somewhat or whether it hasn't collapsed. We wouldn't expect the interference pattern to completely go away. I mean, you can do that. If you have a double-slit system and you close off one of the slits, then interference disappears.
Right.
But mind is not going to act like literally shutting off one mm-hmm. of the slits. It's going to act in a weaker way. And so we look for a decline in interference.
Right.
We have ways of measuring the amount of interference. That then becomes a measure that we're looking for. It's a change in the amount of interference.
This sounds like a far more subtle way of doing things than you have been in the past. And is this part of what's going on in the next book?
No, I do talk about this as one of the experiments in the next book. And I chose this particular direction more from a strategic point of view rather than other reasons. I mean, part of it is that it's strategic, but it also, I think, would be a much more sensitive way of looking at mind-matter interaction than using, for example, a random number generator. Mm-hmm. Because if we go back 50 years ago, the reason why random number generators came about in the first place was to look at the same phenomenon, that consciousness may interact with matter because of the opening provided within quantum theory itself. But the way that this was originally done way back when was you take something like the decay time of a radioactive particle in a piece of uranium, say. Mm-hmm. So that's a purely quantum event. When it occurs, nobody knows, even in principle. Well, maybe things occur like this, that maybe you could intervene with your mind into it. And so you ask somebody to make the decay rate increase just by thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Because maybe what the mind is doing is it's pushing the probabilistic nature of the quantum world around, and you're changing it just slightly so that you'll be able to speed up the decay rate. And now rest, and now make it slow down. And so that idea of taking advantage of random events slowly became, it got turned from radiation as a source into electronic noise into random number generators. And so we have 50 years worth of experiments with random number generators. And people who encountered that for the first time always get puzzled, like, what is the mind interacting with? Is it pushing the electrons around? Is it pushing the components of the circuit around? What's happening in it? Well, it all gets traced back to the idea that maybe there's an aspect of the mind that interacts with quantum probabilities. Mm-hmm. And so the experiment that I've been doing with a double slit is pretty much the same kind of idea, except that rather than squashing the phenomena down into a random generator, which has certain advantages, we're sticking much, much closer to the nature of the signal from a double slit itself. And so I chose that as a direction to go because I can then publish it in the physics literature because it is essentially a physics experiment.
Oh, okay. The other thing I think of as you described it is it's just such a subtle thing that it might be easier to observe a change over a shorter amount of time and a less amount of trials than doing, 4,000 random number generator trials.
And that seems to be the case. So the results that we're getting in this are much more robust than you generally will get in an experiment involving random numbers. Much, much better. So we're...
Sounds like the fly is getting bigger or the sledgehammer is getting smaller.
It's the hammer is getting much smaller.
Yeah.
I think that the size of the actual effect is probably the same as it has always been. While I've worked with a couple of people who seem to have talent in this realm, I think it's more that the nature of our ability to measure is becoming much better because we're getting actually closer to the source of the phenomena itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't get much smaller than a photon.
Yeah.
And a photon is also perfect because it is already mostly wave-like. You know, it shows up like a particle when you capture it, but its behavior before then is basically described in almost perfectly by wave mechanics. So the other advantage of using a double slit system is that we're able to model our apparatus purely in the mathematics using wave mechanics.
Yeah.
And we're able to show then that the interference pattern that we end up with fits almost perfectly what you'd expect to get. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the beauty of physics, that you can take mathematics and say, well, it ought to look this way. And we have the apparatus and we run it, and sure enough, it's really, really close to what the mathematics describe.
Mm-hmm.
That gives us major amount of leverage, because what we could do now is, and in fact, I have my computer running this as we speak, we can then take the results of an experiment and model each interference pattern. So what we're doing is taking 20 images per second of the interference pattern. So we have over half an hour, we have about 30,000 images, and each one's in a classic double slit interference pattern. We have 30,000 of those in a row. For 30 seconds, people are trying to mentally intervene, and then the next 30 seconds they're not intervening. So we have chunks of 600 or so pictures in each of those intervention periods, either concentrating towards it or relaxing away from it. Every single one of those patterns can be mathematically modeled, and we come up with basically an equation, a function, that describes it, and we can decompose it then into each of the elements that are used in creating the double slit apparatus. So what I mean is, you can take that pattern, you can decompose it into the size of each of the individual two slits, the distance from the slits to the camera, the thermal expansion and contraction that goes on in the laser, where the laser is pointing, both X and Y axis, and on and on and on, a whole bunch of different parameters like that. And so you can't do that if you're just working with a raw camera image, but you can in the mathematics, because you can reconstruct what the system was doing in a mathematical way, and now you can go back into the two conditions that we're interested in, concentrating versus relaxing. And you can say, okay, well, we got a significant effect here. The pattern changed. Let's look at what the mathematics said must have happened when the pattern changed. And so one of the parameters that I'm most interested in is how much interference is going on here, because that's what we hope will change when you put your mind into the box. And so if that parameter, this interference parameter, changes as a result of the mental intervention, then you got something. You're able to show, even in the equations, that this is the aspect of the system that is changing in accordance with our hypothesis that mind and matter interact at the quantum level. Now, we could get a different result. We could get a result that says maybe what's going on is that the laser is very subtly expanding or contracting as the experiment's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's true, we can say, well, maybe the reason that that's happening is because when people are asked to concentrate, they actually lean towards the box, and they change it by a hundredth of a degree, and that's a little, just enough thermal energy to make the thing expand a little bit.
Yeah.
When they're asked to relax, they lean back, and it drops by a hundredth of a degree. So that's just one example of many ways of trying to figure out, once you see something, and we are seeing effects, why do we see the effect? And so this is, it's not a new way, but this hasn't been done in a long, long time, to model a system and then use the model as a way of figuring out what's happening.
So, how I understand it is you've gotten to the point where you can take the data that has been collected, see how it's been perturbed, and then trace those back to different parameters and see which one is the one that's being affected the most.
That's exactly right.
Oh.
Yeah. This probably could not have been done 10 years ago, even though the concept was around 10 years ago, because the amount of computing power that it needs in order to do this this amount of analysis, it would have taken forever.
Mm-hmm.
Even as it is now, it takes about 1 hour to analyze one 30-minute session, and it's running flat out on a very fast computer. So.
I see. This is data that you've already collected over however many trials. For some reason, I thought you were running it right this minute, and people were sitting in their living rooms doing this. But you're just crunching numbers.
Yeah, these were data that I collected over last year, and I'm in the process now of writing up the paper and doing the analysis of the type that I just described.
I see.
Yeah, an hour to analyze a half an hour's worth of data.
Not bad.
No. I mean, I would like to have a couple of supercomputers to make this a little faster, but yeah. It's still amazing what we can do.
Yeah, at this point, or either that or, you know, do what the SETI people are doing and just put it out to everybody's computer and see what they can, you know, you can use the combined power of 3,000 home computers to do it.
Yeah, we've considered using the Amazon cloud where you can get 3,000 computers if you want working on the same thing, each one of which doesn't cost much money and solve a problem, a computational problem, much faster.
Yeah.
I haven't taken the next step because I haven't needed to. But if this experiment is successful, then we in fact may go to a cloud solution for that, because otherwise it just takes forever to analyze it.
Yeah. When you mentioned this study, the first thing that came to mind is years ago I had a friend who was a psychologist. He's since passed away. He said that there was a journal, I believe, called the Neuroelectric News Journal. I don't know if you've ever heard of such a thing. I'm at pains to find anything like it, or maybe I wrote down the name wrong. He said he had read a paper in there sometime in the 70s or 80s that discussed systems in aircraft, like in combat aircraft, going wrong at just the right, you know, just the wrong time during the highest period of stress. For you know the pilot, like, and they'd be, you know, very subtle systems like a navigational system or a weapon system particularly, and that this was a problem. They couldn't figure out why it seemed like there was a direct relationship between the stress level of the operator and the system breaking down in some way. Do you know anything about this? Have heard anything about this or worked on anything like this?
Well, the idea of that you're describing is the essence of Murphy's Law.
Yeah.
It's every laboratory doing technological work comes up with Murphy's Law in its own form, because it's we don't know whether it's completely superstition or whether there's some truth to the idea that things like human aggression or anxiety interact with sensitive electronics. In most cases, it doesn't matter so much. If the copy machine breaks at the moment that you really need it, that's an annoyance. But if an aircraft system breaks, that's more dramatic. So this is actually one of the justifications that I used when I was at Bell Labs to say, well, look, you know, we're at the Bell system at the time and still today, the when you place a call somewhere, it's going through all kinds of computers and networks. And if any one of them fails, there's all kinds of redundancy built in to make it invisible to the user that it failed, but it has to redirect. Yeah. You don't want the redirection mechanisms to fail because then the whole thing doesn't work.
Right.
So it's well known that there's sometimes triple redundancy in telephone networks and other large-scale networks now. Even with that, even with triple redundancy, it occasionally fails. And so it's a fine art to figure out why did this fail. And sometimes, a small percentage of time, you have absolutely no idea. We have no idea why this thing failed. It's not even a cosmic ray. It's nothing. So the one thing that's left over as a possibility then is maybe sometimes there's a mind-matter interaction, and it's mediated in some way by someone who's highly anxious. Mm-hmm. So that was the argument that I made, and it was accepted as a viable argument because it's so important to know why things fail that even when you're looking at very low probabilities for explanations, you still need to know it. And so given now that was 25 to 30 years ago when I was doing that, I'm more convinced than ever, based on the experiments that we've done and other people have done, that there is an interaction between attention and intention and the behavior of certain kinds of systems, in which case when you have an aircraft go funny at the wrong time, perhaps it's because there's some system which is susceptible and it just happened to not work, or that it happens to suddenly start working, because it can go in the positive direction too.
Yeah.
there's a opening for interactions.
Is there any way to protect against that, or is it just not even understood well enough that it's not repeatable enough that it's something that anybody can get a handle on?
Well, it's repeatable enough to be turned into folklore, as in Murphy's Law.
Yeah.
Most cases, like especially with Murphy's Law, oftentimes will something gets hardened into one of the laws or the corollaries because whatever went wrong was like really the wrong thing to go wrong at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. And so you only need one event for that to occur. But I remember when working at Bell Labs that there was projects I was working on where oftentimes a lead software developer, the one who had the most invested in the system, they were not allowed to be present during demonstrations because if they were present, it wouldn't work. And it would fail in ways that we had never seen before. It would just, you know, you press a button and like nothing happens. And 20 minutes before the demonstration, you tested it, everything worked fine. And then the dignitary arrives and everybody's in the room and the button is pressed and it's dead. Well, you only need to have that happen once to bar that individual from ever being present ever again. And so that's why we don't keep statistics on such things, but I'm sure that's how many of the legends begin.
I had that happen to me. I was working at, and I think this happens to in a lot of different disciplines, but I was at a theater production. I was doing sound. We'd done, 15 different performances, and I had never done theater sound before. I was just doing it for a friend, and I had some background in audio. And at the one show where all these Hollywood people were there and, executives and actors and all that, I pressed the button on a tape machine, and the only time ever it failed right in the middle of the performance. Mm-hmm. And the people in the theater group said that happens all the time.
Right.
The funny thing was it was during a scene where a demon was supposed to jump out of the radio and start dancing around on a bed. So that was...
That's even better.
Yeah.
Yeah, so how many times does that need to happen for the legend to get turned into something where even if it is just a superstition, you don't want to even deal with that anymore. So
yeah.
Let's just have a rule that you don't do this under certain circumstances.
Yeah, exactly.
So but as I said, I think because there have been enough experiments now looking at this in a more pristine and controlled manner, that at least in principle – that we know that there can be an interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an erratic system or a system on the verge of dying in some way, it might be enough to have strong motivation or strong anxiety to push it over the edge.
Yeah, and that also brings up, this same guy I'm talking about said that he at some point thought it would be interesting, and I think I brought this up with you and you said there are some ethical problems involved. But to take a random number generator and somehow get it installed in a juvenile detention center or a mental institution or something like that and see what would happen to it and what effects would occur around it. Do you know if anybody's ever done something like that?
No, I don't think so. I did do some experiments that actually never worked quite the way I wanted it to, but I went kind of in that direction. And the idea is you create an environment in which you take ordinary objects and you add a random number generator to it, so it becomes erratic. So the objects we're talking about are things like a lamp, like a projector in a movie theater, like a popcorn machine, things that that involve electric currents or electric circuitry, mm-hmm. that you would find in an environment, but you change it so that they are susceptible in a controlled way to either operating correctly or not. And so what I did is I set up a movie that I played, and the movie would, rather than playing back as a uniform 24 frames per second, it would stutter occasionally.
Hmm.
It would slow down, sometimes stop, and then sometimes back up a half a second. And it was a very uncomfortable way of seeing a movie. And
yeah.
I did this intentionally because I figured that if the intention of the audience collectively Like if you're in a movie theater and it goes out of focus, everyone has exactly the same intention, a strong intention to focus this stupid thing.
Yeah.
Well, if that intention collectively can impress itself onto the random system so as to cause the random system to behave in a way to make it focus, well, then you have an implicit PK task, essentially, an implicit psychokinetic task.
Mm-hmm.
So for mine, it was a movie that was stuttering, and there was some evidence that it stuttered less when it was actually playing in front of an audience than it was when it was playing all by itself with nobody watching. So that I did it up to the point where I did a few pilot tests and realized what I really wanted to do was focus and non-focus. But I didn't have a way of – I didn't know how to do that because I was doing it purely through software. If I were to do it again today, I would get something like a little motorized lens that you can put in front of the projector that would actually turn and focus or defocus it automatically.
Yeah.
And then that as an experiment, you know, it would actually be quite interesting to see if the amount of out-of-focus periods was less or more when an audience was watching. And you make a prediction that it's going to be in focus a lot longer than it should be. And that's because of the intention.
Right. But then you'd have to sort of map what the please focus the projector perturbation looked like.
Well, you know through the record. I mean, you have a continual record in an experiment like that of the degree of focus from crystal clear to very unfocused.
Oh, and I see. You're mapping it beforehand.
No, you don't need to set it up beforehand. You can still have a purely random process control the focusing mechanism. But the control then is that let's say you do a movie for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to have a measure at the end of the hour on how much the movie remained in focus. And now you run exactly the same thing, same theater and everything else, except nobody's present.
Right, right.
In which case, there's no intention to try to focus it. And then you can see whether you're getting a random walk as you'd expected.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you would do an experiment of this type.
Well, that also reminds me of the global consciousness experience you've been running for years. Is that still going on, or is that...
Yeah, it's still going. It's 14 years now. The results as of a few days ago when I looked is close to 7 standard errors, which is hundreds and hundreds of billions to 1 against chance.
Uh-huh.
So the longer this experiment runs, the more solid the results get.
Okay, but the idea behind it, if people don't know, is that there are – and correct me if I'm wrong, there are, I don't know how many, random number generators throughout the world are running automatically all the time with a recorder on each, you know, recording if the randomness has, you know, deviated from 50% off or on. And that's that is correlated in some cases with events that affect the entire world, like you know, a particularly good example that you use in the book was 9/11 and how many people heard about it, what had happened, you know, and when they'd heard about it, and how that possibly affected the random number generators all over the world.
Right. So there are roughly 65 generators around the world, and the experiment has a formal way of formal hypothesis. It's often sometimes people think that we're collecting all this random data and we see something happen and then we go back and see if there was an event that we can correlate with it. And of course, that's not what you do. You can do an experiment like that, but it wouldn't be a very legitimate experiment because then you're trying to shoehorn a deviation in randomness against world events and you could always find something.
I see. Yeah.
So we do it the other way around. We say, well, for a planned event, like the opening ceremony of the Olympics or the congressional inauguration or something like that, you plan in advance that you're going to look at a certain period in time. And so you predefine that between the hours of this and that on this day, that's the chunk of data we're going to look at and see whether it's deviating from randomness or not. And the day comes and goes, and you can do the analysis, and you have your result. For an unplanned event, like an earthquake or a terrorist attack, before you look at the data, you then think about the event and what makes sense to look at in terms of the nature of the event. And then you define it. Then you look at the data and you report whatever you get. So there's something like 450 events, both predicted and unpredicted events, that are in the formal database. And when you look at the random data during those 450 events, turns out that they're not so random. And there's lots of ways of checking to see, is it really as deviant as it appears to be? One way is you can say, well, we have 14 years of random data, but the 450 events that we looked at only comprises like 1% of that data. Uh-huh. Like 99% of the database, no one's looked at. We have the data, but it's, nothing happened. Nothing big happened around the world. So you can say, okay, we'll take the 450 events that occurred in time, and we'll take all those events and imagine that you have a very long line that's 14 years long with data on it. The 450 events are scattered among that line. And so now let's take every single event and move it backward by 1 hour. And now move it backward by 2 hours, 3 hours, and so on. And now mm-hmm. let's take the same events and move it forward by an hour, and by 2 hours and 3 hours, and so on. You're taking the events and sliding them back and forth in time as compared to when they actually occurred. And if the hypothesis is correct, that there's something unusual happening about those events, you should find a big spike in the overall odds against chance when the events actually occurred as compared to the same distribution of events but slipped in time, forwards and back. And so when you do that exercise, that's exactly what you find. You find that there's something strange about these particular chunks of time which define the events that were defined before the data was looked at. So this is just one way of checking to make sure that what's going on is really something like an influence or an intervention in randomness rather than simply searching for unexpected periods.
I see. And now I forgot what I was going to ask.
See, it's so stunning
yeah.
to think about it that your mind can just go blank.
My mind goes blank with no influence whatsoever. What's the most recent one that you've like something that was in within the last few months that you that
I could look it up, but I think the presidential election was probably one of the most recent ones.
Okay.
But I will look it up as we speak and see.
The other one when I was thinking of was Felix Baumgartner and how many people were watching that at the same time.
Let's see.
The guy that jumped out of the balloon at, 135,000 feet, something like that.
Right. That is not one of the events.
Hmm.
The last event was, December 4th, a typhoon in the Philippines. Before that, the UN vote on Palestine, and before that, Obama being reelected.
Uh-huh. So, go ahead.
So the overall effect now as of December is Z-score, which is the main statistic, of 6.9. So it's almost 7 standard deviations from chance, and the odds are hundreds of billions to one.
Yeah, and I think it should be sort of explained to people that what happens to the random number generators apparently is some sort of coherence is introduced into their system, which perturbs the absolutely random one and zero virtual coin flips that they're doing all the time.
Right. There's a change in the statistics. And the statistics are, there's a gazillion different ways you can analyze a random system, but this is a very simple way of looking at changes in randomness.
Sorry, I'm waiting for the siren to go by. People say
I hope you're not actually doing this on the street itself, because that would be an unusual place to actually do an interview.
Well, it sounds like it. In fact, people are begging me not to leave the studio and go do the show from my home because they won't hear the wonderful sirens that go by all the time that let them know Now I'm up on the second floor at intersection of two very busy streets in Los Angeles.
I see.
Yeah, and so there apparently we're on the main thoroughfare for all ambulance and fire firefighting vehicles to go.
Oh, well, that's exciting.
it's introducing non-random coherence into the show.
It introduces variance, yes. That's our primary concern of an experimentalist. You want to reduce variance.
I interviewed a remote viewer many years ago, and you might know who this is. He had claimed that he had found out some way of blocking people from doing clean, as it's called, remote viewing with some object. He said he could place and he had done these experiments. We could place an object in the vicinity of wherever the person was supposed to be, you know, viewing, and it would mess up the viewing.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of such a thing?
Not specifically that a particular object, but the idea that you could make something more attractive to the so-called psychic eye. You imagine a psychic eye flying in and looking at a scene. There's some things that will simply be more attractive. And so through what amounts to a kind of camouflage, you, in principle, you could mask the thing that that is the target. So in the classic case, if you have a piece of paper with code words on it, for example, and that's the target, but you also have in the room a nice sparkly thing, like a Christmas tree ornament or something that's rotating and sparkling and just more interesting to look at, that you might be able to deflect the attention.
Yeah. It would seem that it would. I don't know. I was going to say it seems it might be kind of individual for each person, but everybody will look at something sparkly. I mean, it's just your attention is drawn to it.
Yeah, we like sparkly objects. It's not clear in remote viewing what it is that's doing the viewing. In fact, viewing is probably not the right word, but it's the best as we have.
Right.
It's not an eye. You know, it's not going to have all of the usual neural mechanisms involved that are attracted to something sparkly. But it probably has something to do with the brain at some point because information is processed in the brain. Otherwise, people couldn't report it. You know, it wouldn't have to be translated through language and all of that. So it's a combination of ideas that begin to hinge closely and deeply into mystical concepts along with a lot of brain physiology and neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
So some aspects of this make sense from the point of view of what we would think of as ordinary camouflage. But others, we don't know. I mean, you know, if you really wanted to get a code word, you could look at the same information, but not on the day when somebody has put the sparkly object next to it.
Right.
Because unless it's created at the same time as the sparkly object, then if they're slipped in time, will you look at a time when you're not going to be distracted?
Yeah, well, that's another thing that I realized after reading your books and talking to you is the construct of time and how that causality in time may not be what we think and may not even exist, or causality might be backwards as we see it in time.
Yeah, I think causality is a useful concept, but it's probably not absolute. Because, I mean, the moment we've done lots of precognition experiments, and the moment you get the idea that that things are not fixed in time and in the usual way of thinking of it, then all bets are off. And it's because of the issue of time that trying to study psi effects is so difficult. That's what makes it slippery, because it's hard to narrow it down so you know that something occurred at this time. Fortunately, it happens often enough so that you can do experiments that do take place in time. For example, the double sit experiment is 30 seconds of intervention and then 30 seconds of relaxing and so on back and forth with some randomness thrown in. And it's good enough. It's like close enough to that so that we can see a difference in what we're hoping to find. But there have been plenty of other experiments that suggest that strict synchronization in time like that is what we project onto it. It's not really what's going on at a deeper level of reality.
Mm-hmm. another concept you introduce in Entangled Minds, which I think wasn't as much in Conscious Universe, is that there are two sides of the psi research coin. One of them is, and which has been going on for hundreds of years, is the if it exists or not. Yes, well, it does exist. And if you've done any of the research, looked at the studies, looked at the results over and over and over again, yes, it's there. Yes, it is repeatable in many ways. However, there's not too much in the first book about the how. Entangled Minds mm-hmm. does go into the how just a bit. And in the 20 minutes we have left, maybe you could attempt to kind of summarize the how that you've come to. Why does psychic phenomena work? Why does it exist? And what might be the quote-unquote mechanism behind it, the why? Or the how.
In 20 minutes.
Well, I don't know. It's as short as you're going to make. I just looked up at the clock and I said, oh, geez, we only have 20 minutes left.
Yeah. Well, time is an illusion.
Yeah, I know.
It's
except 20, when the guy walks in and
20
says,
hours, same
yeah.
thing.
Except when the guy walks in and says, I need to do my show now, then it ceases to be. The function has collapsed and he has to take the station That's from me. Yeah.
So the summary then is basically this, that I can do the same spiel from a mystical point of view or from a scientific point of view. So I'll just do the science one.
All right.
One of the implications of, and when you're thinking now about the ontology suggested by quantum mechanics, is that we live in not only a holistic environment, because I think all scientists ultimately accept that the reason why we call it a universe is because it's just one thing. Science chops up the world into little pieces because none of us are smart enough to understand everything. In a holistic medium, we develop theories that are suitable for those, for each little discipline, and it's easy to forget that we're all trying to explain the same thing. And quantum mechanics suggested at a deep physical level that everything is connected in some way. It's not exactly matter, and it's not exactly energy. It's more like information or relationships. That's what a deeper reality than common sense tells us. That's what it is. Some others suggest that it's the nature of that deeper reality is holographic. We're all familiar with holograms. A quantum hologram is kind of like the idea of a holographic picture, except that it exists in space-time, or actually beyond space-time. So you have some kind of a structure or medium that connects everything. Well, if that's the case, then consciousness is part of everything too. And so there should be some aspect of consciousness which is also connected with everything. If that's true, I mean, if first of all, when you think about a holistic environment, nothing can be isolated from it by definition.
Right.
Everything's connected. So right. If as long as consciousness is imagined to be either part of brain structure or to be separate or something, it's still in the universe. It's all going to be connected in some way. If that is true, then humans evolved and our brains evolved and babies evolved with this already in place. Our brain is evolving in an environment where a lot of it is localized through the physicality of it, but its operation is still holistic. It's still part of it is connected with everything else. And I'm saying this now from almost a mainstream neuroscience point of view. There's no mystical aspect of this that's even necessary.
Yeah.
The brain, the neurons, all of it evolves in an environment which part of it is connected with everything else. Well, if that's the case, then you can have a metaphor of your awareness is a little bit like having a walkie-talkie on a certain channel open all the time to a loved one's walkie-talkie on the same channel, which is also open all the time. Mm-hmm. So you and that person might be far from each other, but there's a little trickle of sound going in your ear all the time, which is telling you what's happening to the other person and vice versa. It's like an open channel constantly feeding information about what's going on. That's the connectivity we're talking about. So most of the time, you're hearing noise. It doesn't make any difference. But on one occasion, you might hear something which attracts your attention. You hear your name called because the person at the other end of the walkie-talkie says your name for some reason. Well, your attention will immediately be attracted to your partner at a distance. People report that as telepathy. By the same token, if there's something important to you that happens to be occurring somewhere else, the same portion of your brain that's involved mostly in processing visual information coming in from your eyes and the rest of your senses, some of that is distributed too. It's elsewhere. So mm-hmm. a little piece of your sensory processing information or processing part of your brain is now going to process something that is actually not coming through your senses, ordinary senses, but your what we might call extended senses, the part of you which is distributed everywhere else. And so that's clairvoyance. By the same token, the connectivity we're talking about is not just in space. It's also in time. So if you're attracted to something that happened in the past or something in the future, well, it's retrocognition and precognition. So all of the psychic phenomena are falling out of a deep connectivity to everything in the universe that is not bound by space and time. And as I said, the part of this is metaphor, but part of it is, as best as we can tell, the best physical explanation or story that is painted by quantum mechanics. Now, there are a number of things about the story that don't quite fit, so we don't want to rest our theoretical shingle on quantum mechanics as we currently understand it. But quantum mechanics is not the end of the story, and eventually we'll get more and more refined versions of this. It would be extremely unlikely that if you've already advanced to the point where you're dealing with holism, that the next phase of development will no longer be holistic. It would more likely be something like hyper-holistic, mm-hmm. a form of holism that we don't even have words for yet, that will make it even maybe holistic on other dimensions or something. At that point, then some of the holes that we – or the loopholes that we can't quite close yet with existing quantum mechanics might be easier and easier to close, in which case what we'll move towards is we'll look more and more like the mystical notion that the universe really is one holistic entity, and that the metaphor that is commonly used, which is probably close to some level of truth, is that what we individually experience as our own conscious awareness and our locality is the equivalent of the cresting of a wave on the ocean. So the analogy is that you're flying over the ocean looks pretty flat, but you can sometimes see white caps, and white caps look like they're little independent white things that are sitting on top of the ocean. But of course, if you're actually down at the ocean level, you see that it's actually a momentary effect of the dynamism of the mm-hmm. medium itself creates a cresting wave. And so a mystic would say that all there is this ocean of consciousness. All structure, all form, time, energy, all of these concepts come about as a result of changes in the form of this underlying medium, like the ocean. And so I would guess that we're going to move more and more closely to that picture of reality. And in some respects, this has to be true, because if you imagine that some far portion of our history, that science progresses and it gets better and better descriptions of the nature of reality, that ought to converge with the other traditions that have also tried to do the same thing. I'm talking about the traditions of several thousand years of people who do meditation. Mm-hmm. So they have come to certain pictures of reality. They would use different language to describe it, but the essence of it ought to be about the same as what science goes towards, because if they diverge, that would be kind of puzzling. I mean, that would suggest that the tradition of several thousand years of meditation is completely delusional. It's not connected with reality at all. Well, there's probably some distortions in say, the yogic path, just as there are distortions in the scientific path. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can look in textbooks like the ones that are redone every year. You go back 10 years and like half of the book will be different. And you go back another 10 years and it'll be still different. Textbooks from a century ago are laughable now. So there's an evolution towards what we hope is better and better descriptions in science. I assume the same is true in traditions that were just as scholarly but using different methods, namely introspection. And so I'm guessing. I think it's an article of faith, but I'm guessing that far enough in the future they will converge. When, as we get closer and closer to the convergence, it'll be more and more obvious. You don't have to do a lot of hand-waving to make that justification. And when it reaches, at that point, our description of what we think we are and the way civilization works and all kinds of things will be radically different than the way we think of it today. Mm-hmm. Like at that point, the difference between science and spirituality will probably have vanished. We'll have scientific terms for spiritual concepts and vice versa.
Right.
The notion of traditional religion will probably dissolve because we'll have rational and maybe hyper-rational ways of thinking about things that used to be only in the domain of religion. So I'm optimistic that this convergence will happen. I have no idea when it would happen because it's not only dependent on advancements in science, but it's very heavily dependent on politics and the state of civilization and economics and everything else.
Right.
But in principle, I think the convergence, we're headed towards a convergence, and someday we'll look back on our struggles today, and similar to how we look back for people in the medieval times, trying to, like one of the things I talk about in my new book is magnetism. We have models that describe magnetic properties pretty well, and we use it for all kinds of sorts of interesting things. But fundamentally, we still don't completely understand what it is. Nevertheless, because we can use it pragmatically, we don't care too much anymore. There are very few people who worry about the fact that we don't understand fundamental properties too well. So we kind of set that aside and look back at the history of how long did it take from when people first noticed things like lodestone having these strange properties. How long did it take from there until we were able to understand it well enough to be able to make things like electric motors? Well, it took something like 500 years.
Yeah.
And this is, we're not dealing here with something like psi, which is hard to demonstrate reliably. We had magnets for a long, long time and were able to demonstrate it easily. And it took a long time to figure out ways of understanding it. It took development of new, whole new realms of mathematics, whole new ways of thinking about things. Well, the same is true now. So there are all kinds of things we don't understand very well now, which may require the development of new instruments, new mathematics, new all kinds of stuff. And the description then of what we will discover when the convergence happens is probably beyond our imagination today. It would sound like complete fantasy. So I'm not sure whether that describes how psi works, because at this point we're dealing more with speculation than anything else. But yeah. What it does do is says that if what is needed for psi to exist comfortably in the scientific worldview is the development of a physics that is in the direction that physics is going.
Right. And then I guess more importantly, an acceptance of it so that, like you said, an acceptance of, well, magnets work, but we don't really know how, but let's proceed, even though we don't understand how it works, proceed to see what we can do with it. Maybe we can find out more about the nature of it in that way. And then in that way, you know, whatever elephant everybody's staring at or pulling at or whatever, to use that analogy, maybe more people will be able to see it for what it is. And mm-hmm. When you're describing this, I get the idea that there's going to be some small group of people that start this, and that just kind of takes a while for it to accrete to the point where more people seem to get it and, you know, roll over all the conventions and or at least bypass them.
Well, there is another scenario is that the psi research as a discipline will keep bubbling in the background for a long time. And instead, what will happen is that through biophysics, in particular quantum biology, that interest in that field will continue to grow, that eventually somebody will discover that biological systems actually require quantum effects in order to do what they do. Mm-hmm. Through that line of research, people will begin to bump up against questions like what would happen if a brain was a quantum computer, for example, or it acted like a quantum computer. What would be the consequences of that? And somebody will say, who had never heard of anything psychic, they will say, well, maybe you'd get information from the future, maybe you'd get information from a distance, you know, maybe. All of the phenomena they'd be talking about would be basically psi. Then they'd say, well, okay, let's try an experiment to see whether information could come from the future that a quantum brain could get. Mm-hmm. And they'll do experiments with neurons in a dish or something, and they'll find that, sure enough, there's evidence for retrocausation in a quantum computing brain. And somebody will have the bright idea that maybe, well, that sounds kind of like precognition, like what people report. And then someone will find the century and a half worth of literature saying that, well, sure enough, if you do this with people, you do find these effects. And so this is a way of taking what used to be a fringe discipline and saying, oh, the mainstream has bumped up against it and rediscovered it. And so the rediscovery scenario, I think, is also a likely thing that could happen.
Right. Okay, well, we're just about out of time. What is the next book again? I'm sorry, what is the title?
The title is Supernormal: Science, Yoga, and the Evidence for Extraordinary Psychic Abilities.
Would you mind being
published?
Oh, go ahead.
It'll be published by Random House, and it's part of the new imprint by Deepak Chopra at Random House.
Well, then I'll have to call you up and have you back on again when that book comes out.
Okay.
If you don't mind, because I did mention at the beginning of the show that interview I did with you in 1997, I thought it was important enough for me that I actually reprinted almost the entirety of it in the excluded middle book when it came out. Did you ever get a copy of that?
I do. I have a copy, yes.
Oh, okay. Good. Because it's the longest interview in the book. I think it's like 30 pages.
But it's frightening, yeah. Actually, to look at it.
But, you know, people that have read the entirety of it basically had the same reaction that I did. This, yes, that should the entire interview should have been in there, because the concepts in it are not familiar to most people, still aren't. And to understand them is to just be able to get the barest bit of a handle on what your research is and the implications are. And it's fascinating to me, and I think the listeners will find it such. I will post this show in the next couple of days, and I will, of course, send you a link to it so that you can direct people to it. Thank you
Very
so
good.
Much, Dr. Radin.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I will communicate with you again soon, I hope.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so
Thank
much.
You. Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye. Dr. Dean Radin, his newest book will be out next year, and the two that we talked about during the show were The Conscious Universe and Entangled Minds. Probably a good idea to read both of those and get some insight from them, in addition to what we talked about here on the show. Fascinating stuff. It always, I feel like I'm so lucky to have had him on. So we'll see you in a week.
We've got extrasensory perception. It makes our love unique. There isn't any doubt or question when into your mind I can peek. Not with extrasensory perception, our love will grow and grow. You won't have to worry or wonder. Just look in my head and you'll know. You'll know the secrets that are in my heart. You'll know the reason and the rhyme. We'll be together when we're far apart. Baby, you'll be with me all the time. With extrasensory perception, our love will be refined. Since our affair had its inception, I can't get you out of my mind. There is no chance of a deception. How dull it's gonna be. Let's go find two normal people. Baby, stop thinking at me.
What was that you thought?